ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Thursday, the 14th of March. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, TikTok trouble. The US House of Representatives passes a bill that could ban the app. Should Australia do the same? And hundreds of innocent post office managers in the UK to be exonerated after being falsely convicted of fraud and theft.
We've battled from 2009 to 2019 when we beat them in court. So that was a 10-year fight to get justice. This whole thing just makes me so angry. There are 490-odd people that are literally hanging by a thread.
Some Palestinians who've managed to flee Gaza have had their temporary Australian visas cancelled, leaving them stranded in other countries. The federal government has granted more than 2,200 temporary visas for Palestinians with connections to Australia and around 2,400 for Israelis. Political reporter Chantal Al-Khoury has been following the story. I spoke to her a short time ago.
These are subclass 600 temporary visas. They were granted to Israelis and Palestinians as early as November last year. So basically, this visa type means recipients can't work or access education or healthcare in Australia. Now, I've obtained some of the cancellation letters of some of the people that applied back in November. They'd been approved and only cancelled within the past 2 weeks. We've also spoken to some of their family members here who applied on their behalf. They're now stuck in foreign countries where they have no legal status and can't return to Gaza. Now, those cancellation letters that I've seen, they say that these people were required to meet a subsection that states the applicant intends to stay temporarily in Australia. It says the delegate considered the situation in their home country, including the current conflict, the internal displacement of persons, and the difficult circumstances facing the ordinary citizens there, and considered they never intended a genuine stay temporarily in Australia. Of course, that's causing a lot of confusion because people are questioning, how do you assess something like that?
Chantal, what are the families telling you?
Yeah, so I've spoken to a lot of families who are genuinely very confused and quite frightened about the situation here. We spoke to a woman in Australia who applied for two of her sisters and her nieces. They were approved back in November. Obviously, like a lot of Palestinians that were trying to get out of Gaza, they were unable to leave for months. They waited to get a green light from border officials after successfully making it out of Rafah a couple of months later, finally. One sister had her Australian visa cancelled in Cairo. Then the other sister made it to a transit country with her four children. And then they were told right before their flight, as they were about to get on, that mother had her visa cancelled, but her children were still able to board the plane. So they're stuck in Cairo at the moment. Obviously, there's a lot of questions. We did speak to the Palestine Australia Relief and Action Foundation. Rafa Abbas is the co-founder. She says there's a duty of care from the government here to support these people and says that the community are distressed.
There are people who've paid their life savings or their family here in Australia had to borrow money to pay for their exit out of Gaza. And they wouldn't have done that without the hope of reuniting with them here in Australia.
That's Rasha Abbas there from the Palestine Australia Relief and Action Foundation. Chantal, what do we know about what these families have been through in Gaza?
The lack of safety, I think, is obviously a concern for people here who have loved ones over there. They can't stay in Egypt. They can't go to Gaza. And now they're not able to come back to Australia. We did hear from Samar Sabwi as well, who's the co-founder of that organisation I mentioned. They've been helping Palestinians settle here in Australia. Here's some of what she had to say about their situation.
It's a very difficult place to be when you've lost everything. They're, you know, when we meet them as they arrive, they have nothing on them. They have nothing. Their entire history has been wiped out. They don't have photos. They don't have clothes. They don't even have toothpaste. They come hungry. They come tired, exhausted, terrified. Some of the children, they just cry for hours.
Samar Sabawi there, the co-founder of the Palestinian Australia Relief and Action Association. And Chantelle, what reaction have we had from the federal government?
Yeah, so last night we heard from a spokesperson for the Home Affairs Minister, Claire O'Neill. They said that they wouldn't be commenting on individual cases due to what they cite as privacy reasons, but they did say all visa applicants undergo security checks and are subject to ongoing security assessments, and that the Australian government reserves the right to cancel any issued visas if those circumstances change. Now, I've spoken to some people who obviously are in this situation, who have family that have applied for visas or have had them cancelled. They say this is not good enough. The government needs to do more to reassure some people that this isn't going to happen to their family members too. But most of all, they're just trying to get answers.
That's a political reporter, Chantelle Alkhouri in Canberra. The Australian Workers Union says the death of a miner at a Ballarat gold facility could have been avoided. Victoria Police have confirmed that one man has been killed and another remains in a critical condition in hospital after a rock fall tragedy yesterday evening. The mining community across the country is grieving the loss, as Anna Pikett reports.
Disaster struck at the gold mine at Mount Clear near Ballarat, an hour and a half outside of Melbourne, around 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Police say a team of 30 were working 500 metres underground when the collapse occurred. A 37-year-old man from Bruthen in Victoria's East did not survive, police saying his body was recovered early this morning. Lisa McDougall is acting inspector with Victoria Police in Ballarat. She says the rescue operation was complex.
There were a few phases. Obviously, yesterday evening, we had the initial patient that was transferred to the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, and he was in a critical and life-threatening position at that point, and I understand that that remains to be the case. And then obviously the other phase of that was extracting the other workers that were inside the refuge areas of the mine, and then accessing the second patient was undertaken, and there had to be significant efforts by rescue teams to make access to that person safe.
Ballarat City Mayor Des Hudson says this accident is the latest in a long list of challenging events for his community, including devastating bushfires and the continued search for missing Ballarat mother Samantha Murphy.
Our hearts and minds and love is with the family of that person who has died, and especially to also the rescue teams that are still working for the recovery of that person's body to be able to be brought to the surface.
Steve Smythe is the General Vice President of the Mining and Energy Union. He says it's a difficult day for the mining community across the country.
It's absolutely tragic, and it has a ripple effect, not just within the community where this person's lost his life, but right across the mining community of Australia. Mining's close-knit. People that work in mining understand the hazards and the dangers and the risks, but certainly when something like this brings it home, it's another miner that went to work and never returned home, and it's simply just not good enough.
Mining regulations vary across Australia, but Mr. Smythe says certain jurisdictions are better than others.
The coal mining legislation in the states of Queensland and New South Wales are, in my opinion, are far more superior or stronger than the other states. The other states do have good legislation, but the problem is that they're all grouped in together with just general workplace health and safety. From the MEU's perspective, we need to be developing our legislation and our laws that actually suit the activities that are undertaken in these mines.
Ronnie Hayden is the secretary of the Victorian branch of the Australian Workers' Union. He says workers at the gold mine were performing a style of mining that had not been performed in Ballarat for years, and that most mines had stopped doing because it was unsafe.
We had two workers that were bare-legging, which is a manual style of mining. It's our understanding that they were working under unsupported ground and that ground gave way, trapping both miners and killing one.
Ronnie Hayden says concerns about this technique have been raised at the facility in the past. He's pushing WorkSafe to look at possible industrial manslaughter charges over the fatality.
Our members on this mine over the past few years have raised concerns about and our organisers have been out onto site to make sure that our members weren't working under unsupported ground. Our members have raised concerns about this style of mining, and it seems they've fallen on deaf ears.
The owner of Ballarat Gold Mine, Victory Minerals, has expressed its sympathies to the family of the deceased worker and says it's focusing on supporting its staff and their families. The ABC has contacted the company about the union's claims. WorkSafe is investigating the incident and Victoria Police will prepare a report for the coroner.
That's Anna Pikett. You're listening to The World Today. The United States House of Representatives has passed a bill that could see TikTok banned in the US. The video platform is used by more than 170 million Americans. But both Democrats and Republicans are worried the Chinese owner of the app could be passing on user data to the Chinese government. Angus Randall reports.
In a rare display of unity, US politicians have taken the biggest step yet towards banning TikTok. Outside Congress, influencers bussed in by the video platform say it risks destroying their livelihood.
I'm here because I'm a disability advocate and TikTok changed my life and so many others within the disability community.
TikTok has allowed my dreams that I used to have as a child to come true.
It completely changed my life. I went from literally sleeping in my truck to living in a penthouse to now employing people.
The bill that's passed the House of Representatives would force TikTok's Chinese owner ByteDance to divest from TikTok or be banned from America entirely. The unprecedented action is due to fears TikTok could pass on user data to the Chinese government, something the company denies. TikTok says more than 170 million Americans use the platform. In Australia, there are more than 8 million active users. Sam Kelly is a managing partner at Hello Social and deputy chair of the Australian Influencer Marketing Council.
As social media practitioners, we've seen a number of flare-ups with these sorts of headlines develop both here locally and out of the US and other regions, in fact, for the last 5 or 6 years. I think governments are on the scramble to keep up with, I guess, the scale and complexity of social media. So I think, look, it's something we are all watching with interest, but the industry will be strong. And if things were to change, we'd just see a shift back to some of those other platforms and channels.
The bill still has to pass the US Senate, and it would likely then face a barrage of legal challenges. The state of Montana tried to bring in a TikTok ban last year, but it's been blocked by a judge pending an appeal. Caitlin Chin Rothman is a tech policy researcher at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She says it could be a long time before the app is wiped from American phones.
Legal challenges could potentially take years, and the government will have a very high bar to pass in order to prove that it has the legal grounds to ban TikTok.
In Australia, TikTok is banned on all government devices over fears of foreign interference. But this morning, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said there were no plans for a nationwide ban.
Look, we have made decisions based upon our own security assessments. We're independent. We don't follow other countries. What we do is we make decisions based on our security assessments.
Professor Lyria Bennett-Moses is the director of the UNSW Allen's Hub for Technology, Law and Innovation. She says it can be hard to assess the risk TikTok poses.
There have certainly been examples in the media of information, for example, being shared with Chinese employees. There's the risk in terms of Chinese law that companies may be required to disclose data. The structure here is also a little bit complicated, where a company is headquartered in Beijing, but actually registered in the Cayman Islands and so forth, and then that relationship to TikTok itself. So it's a complicated thing.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry says the US has never found evidence that TikTok threatens US national security, and a ban would damage the international economic order.
That's Angus Randall there. Hundreds of innocent UK post office branch managers who were wrongly convicted of theft, fraud, and false accounting will soon be exonerated. Some served prison time, even though a faulty computer system was the real culprit of the financial irregularities. The British government has introduced a bill to enact landmark legislation, which will quash the criminal charges and also pave the way for compensation. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss reports from London.
The computer system Post Office spent an arm and a leg on is faulty.
No one else has ever reported any problems with Horizon. No one.
It was this television series released by British broadcaster ITV in January that drew attention to one of Britain's biggest miscarriages of justice.
You're responsible for the loss.
I haven't got that money, and I don't know where it's gone.
These deficits were most...
Public outrage over the scandal erupted, but for the victims, hundreds of post office branch managers, they'd already spent decades fighting for their innocence. Some served prison time, many were financially ruined. Joe Hamilton was a post office manager in a village southwest of London. Her conviction of false accounting was quashed in 2021. She's only just settled.
We've battled from 2009 to 2019 when we beat them in court. So that was a 10-year fight to get justice.
The legislation introduced into Parliament today will immediately exonerate more than 700 wrongfully prosecuted sub-postmasters and unlock compensation of around $1.2 million each. But hundreds of others not convicted of a crime, yet out of pocket for having to dip into their savings to balance the books, are still waiting for just compensation. It was this group which initially took the government to court, exposing the scandal.
This whole thing just makes me so angry when they stand in Parliament and they say stuff and it's like you're just deflecting from the fact there are 490 odd people that are literally hanging by a thread. Some of them are literally, I mean, there was a lady interviewed on the television, she's 91. You know, how much longer do you wait?
Journalist Carl Flinders has reported on the story since 2010. He believes the government only rushed to prepare the legislation because it's an election year and the television series attracted negative coverage.
People are getting older. People are never going to see them get paid. And this is just money that was stolen, taken from them, a lot of it. You know, it's just what they paid back to the post office in phantom losses that didn't exist. So, I mean, they're only really asking for the money back first and then compensation on top.
Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak told Parliament he wants the legislation passed before the middle of the year.
I want to pay tribute to all postmasters who have campaigned tirelessly for justice, including those who tragically won't see the justice that they deserve. Today's legislation marks an important step in finally clearing their names, and across this House we owe it to them to progress this legislation as soon as possible before summer recess.
For victims, it's already been a long and arduous legal journey for justice. No one from the post office nor the software provider Fujitsu have faced any charges over the scandal.
That's our Europe correspondent Catherine Diss. Senior staff at Queensland's frontline tuberculosis unit say they've been persecuted by the state's health department after raising concerns. The unit's senior physician and a former head nurse have made complaints to the Crime and Corruption Commission seeking whistleblower protection. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
The Tuberculosis Control Unit at the Torres and Cape Hospital and Health Service was established to combat TB in Queensland, but senior staff say they uncovered inconsistencies in the way Queensland Health decided which Papua New Guinean patients to treat at the state's hospitals. They looked at the treatment of 200 people in the outer islands of the Torres Strait.
We found that this group of people, they were young, they were quite sick, 10 of them didn't make it home, they died in hospital, and another 10 were referred back to Papua New Guinea and we have no records of them ever making it to hospital.
Infectious diseases expert Dr. Emma McBride is the unit's senior physician. Dr. McBride and another senior nurse who's asked not to be identified outlined their evidence in a paper published in the Journal of Tropical Medicine and Infectious Disease.
So we examined the decision-making that occurred at the border by Queensland Health nurses and doctors, and we acknowledged in this paper that there were great pressures and the decision making was very challenging at the border.
They didn't name names or identify particular clinical decisions, and they raised the issues with Queensland Health. But after publication, Dr. McBride says there was a backlash.
Once it became public, we have seen nothing but retaliation and retribution. It has been extremely hard on the senior nurse in the TB unit, who is also the lead author in this paper, that she has borne the brunt of the bullying.
Dr. McBride says she's also been impacted.
For myself, it's been an enormous distraction. It's been difficult. And it's also just been disappointing because this is the sort of study that Queensland Health should be embracing to try and improve the services. And instead we've seen retaliation and retribution. And that's why I referred the matter to the Queensland Corruption Crime Commission and became an official whistleblower.
The head nurse received a number of breach notifications and was eventually removed, leading Dr McBride, who remained at the unit, to ask questions.
And at one point, the TB unit had no nurses employed. And at a meeting where I questioned this and questioned what was going on and wondered who was actually in charge of the unit, I was given a letter to say that suggest that I was being extremely rude and unprofessional.
Queensland Health Minister Shannon Fentiman says she's concerned by the claims.
These allegations are so serious, when they came to my attention, I've immediately referred them to the CCC for investigation.
But the pair say they already complained to the watchdog last year and it was then referred back to the department.
So I sought further information from the Torres and Cape HHS, and the information that I received, I felt warranted further investigation by the CCC. So I've now referred all of the material to the CCC for further investigation.
After the nurse raised concerns, the department hired a prominent criminal law specialist to investigate her for alleged insubordinate and undermining behaviour. Ms Fentiman couldn't confirm whether that was common practice, but says it needs to be taken up with Queensland Health. Dr McBride says she's shocked by the department's actions.
Unfortunately, this is sending a very clear signal that if you want to make some improvements inside Queensland Health, your position is under threat.
Queensland Health was contacted for comment. A spokesperson said because the matter has been referred to the CCC, it would be inappropriate to comment.
It's Elizabeth Cramsey and Rory Callanan reporting. Finally today, some North Queensland locals are offering their homes to fans of the US pop star Pink, who is preparing to perform in Townsville. Thousands of music enthusiasts are desperate to see Pink on stage, but some say they don't have any accommodation due to inflated prices. Fellow fans and locals are now offering places to stay to help them out, as Georgia Loney reports.
Cairns resident Rowena Pretty and her friend were so excited to see Pink in Townsville, they booked their accommodation 6 months in advance.
We actually got our ticket in the first run for the Saturday night, and immediately the friend that I'm going with started calling around hotels, because obviously the ones online booked out pretty fast, even on that first day. And so she rang around and managed to find us a room for $189, and we thought we were all sorted.
But less than 2 weeks out from the concert, they got a call to say the hotel had made a mistake and the room's price was no longer $189 a night, but more than three times that.
It's completely and utterly price gouging. The tickets went on sale in August last year, so that's, what, 6 months ago?
Yeah.
And they said that their systems only roll over prices within a certain time frame.
A spokesperson for the hotel says it was a one-off error, and it's not unusual for the accommodation industry to keep rates fluid during periods of high demand. But Rowena Pretty's problem isn't unique. 40,000 Pink fans are due to arrive in the North Queensland city next week to see the musician on stage, and many are looking for affordable accommodation. Kylie Morgan has been lobbying for Pink to visit Townsville.
Her songs relate to everybody in different ways. It has brought people together.
When she realised fellow fans were stuck, she put out a call on social media to help find places for people to stay.
People are still searching for accommodation. Just because the prices were just so high. And so, yeah, we put a post up saying, you know, if you still need an accommodation or if you've got a room available, so that we can try and get as many people help as possible, so that we can just, you know, come together as a Pink community.
It's worked for Rowena Pretty, who says after her initial price spike shock, she's found an even better place to stay.
We found amazing accommodation with a local who has a self-contained granny flat on their property. And we're quite honestly much happier to be supporting her and her family than supporting a big organisation that's just trying to take advantage of locals.
So is it a bad look for Townsville tourism with prices spiking for special events? Lisa Wolfe from business group Townsville Enterprise says demand for accommodation is high, but the city can cope.
We are currently sitting at 90%, but do expect to completely sell out for the weekend. And we know from ticket sales that there will be 40,000 visitors coming into Townsville for, to raise their glasses and celebrate Pink being in town. We certainly are encouraging people to contact hotels directly to find out about availability for rooms and also locals to open their available rooms and spaces up as well.
Fans still on the hunt for a bed have just over a week to lock in accommodation, with Pink due to hit the stage next Friday and Saturday night.
That's Georgia Loney reporting. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Decades ago, when other countries were embracing nuclear power, Australia put a ban on it. Now the federal opposition wants to lift that ban and build nuclear power plants on the sites of ageing coal-fired power stations. Today, we look into the feasibility of that idea. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.